Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 4th canto, 24th chapter, 38th verse. Asatmane nama urja ishe tvaya. Nama urja ishe traya. Pataye yagyare tase. Pataye yagyare tase. Triptidaya cha jivanam. Triptidaya cha jivanam. Namasarvara satmane. Namasarvara satmane. I offer all obeisances unto you. Urje, unto the provider of the Pichiloka. Ishe, the provider of all the demigods. Traya, of the three Vedas. Pataye, unto the master. Yajna, sacrifices. Retase, unto the predominating deity of the moon planet. Triptidaya, unto him who gives satisfaction to everyone. Cha, also. Jivanam, of the living entities. Namaha, I offer my obeisances. Sarvarasa Atmane, unto the all-pervading super soul. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. My Lord, you are the provider of the Pitrilokas as well as all the demigods. You are the predominating deity of the moon and the master of all three Vedas. I offer my respectful obeisances unto you because you are the original source of satisfaction for all living entities. Responsibly. My Lord, you are the provider of the Pitrilokas as well as all the demigods. You are the predominating deity of the moon and the master of all three Vedas. I offer my respectful obeisances unto you because you are the original source of satisfaction for all living entities. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. When the living entity is born with this material world, especially as a human being, he has several obligations unto the demigods, unto the saintly persons, and unto living entities in general. As enjoined in the Shastras, Devarshibhu Tattva Nrinam Pitrinam. Thus one has an obligation to one's forefathers, the previous hierarchy. Lord Jiva prays to Lord Aniruddha to give him strength so he can become free from all obligations to the Pitas, demigods, general living entities, and saintly persons completely engage himself in the devotional service of the Lord. As stated, Devarshipu Tattva Nrinam Pitrinam Kinkaro Nayam Nrini Charajan Savatmanaya Sharanam Sharanyam Gato Mukundam Parihitya Kartam. From Bhagavatam, 11th canto, 5th chapter, 41st verse. One becomes free from all obligations to demigods, saintly persons, pitas, ancient forefathers, etc., if one is completely engaged in the devotional service of the Lord. Lord Shiva therefore prays to Lord Aniruddha to give him strength so that he can be free from such obligations and entirely engaged in the Lord's service. Soma, or the predominating deity of the moon, is responsible for the living entity's ability to relish the taste of food through the tongue. Lord Shiva prays to Lord Aniruddha to give him strength so he will not taste anything but the prasada of the Lord. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur has sung a verse indicating that the tongue is the most formidable enemy among all the senses. If one can control the tongue, he can easily control the other senses. The tongue can be controlled only by eating prasada offered to the Lord. Lord Shiva's prayer to Lord Aniruddha is meant for this purpose, Riptidaya. He prays to Lord Aniruddha to help him be satisfied by eating only prasadam offered to the Lord. Om Ganati Mirandasya Gananjana Salataya Chakshuram Valitam Jena Prasmaya Sri Gurudana Sri Ketanamana Vishtam Stati Tham Jena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Karati Swahuram Sujana. First line, within this material. Yeah, I was wondering what that was. When a living entity is born within this material world, especially as a human being, he has several obligations unto the demigods. This is the older version, huh? Oh, really? There's a vast network of karma, we might say, when we come into this material world, when we're born within this material world. Sometimes, I guess in general, people think that little babies are innocent, or young children are innocent. But actually, it's a great punishment that we're carrying with us to have been born within this material world. And as we know, some are born rich, some are born poor, some are born beautiful, some are born not so attractive. Some live for a short time, some live for a long time, because we understand that the workings of karma are very complex and very difficult to understand. But just to be born in this material world is a symptom that we have rebelled against the Supreme Lord. So we're not innocent when we come to this world. When some little baby dies seemingly prematurely, we understand there's a karmic reaction, some punishment has taken place. So, of course, Lord Shiva is very, very advanced. He's said to present, to embody 88% of qualities of Vishnu. He's a very, very powerful demigod. Not an ordinary person can ever be imitated. Srila Prabhupada said sometimes people try to imitate Lord Shiva by taking a ganja. He said Lord Shiva drank an ocean of poison. But Lord Shiva could drink an ocean of poison. He did, and he wasn't affected by it. So no one can compare to Lord Shiva. But as Krishna himself took on a spiritual master and a teacher, and Balaram, Lord Chaitanya, took on a spiritual master. He was also the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Lord Shiva, also for purposes of instruction and for the desire to attain more and more purification, to be more solely devoted in pure devotional service, because he's great, he feels very humble. He's praying to the Lord to engage in full devotional service. Lord Shiva also has a very intimate relationship with Lord Krishna. When Lord Krishna manifested himself as Mohini Murti, the most beautiful woman in the universe, he was, as we read in the Srimad Bhagavatam, the ninth canto, he was playing a game, kind of an internal pastime, with Lord Shiva. And Lord Shiva became attracted by this irresistible form, a beautiful female form. This was an arrangement by Krishna. Lord Shiva is never actually disturbed. He's never sexually agitated. Even when his consort is becoming very, very intimate with him, even touches the private parts of his body, he's not agitated. But in order to teach a lesson to everyone, he became very attracted to this Mohini Murti. He was, of course, irresistible as a pastime of Lord Krishna. So he tried to embrace her. Every time he tried to embrace her, she slipped away, just disappeared, slithered away from his embrace. And then she began to run away from him. And Lord Shiva, apparently infatuated with this beautiful female form, began to run after Mohini Murti. As they were running, the Lord in this female form ran before many great sages who were meditating in their hermitages. And as they were passing by the great sages, by the arrangement of Lord Krishna, Lord Shiva was passing Semana as if he were overly infatuated with sexual desire. And this was witnessed by the great sages. The arrangement had been made for Krishna not to bewilder Lord Shiva, but to instruct the sages, because they began to, in their meditation, they began to see this. They saw the spectacle, and they began to think, what is this? If even it appears Lord Shiva can be overcome by lust, what can I expect to achieve here? An ordinary living entity sitting in meditation, how can I be successful? So in order to teach them a lesson of how powerful Maya is, the Lord performed this pastime, and Lord Shiva was apparently bewildered, although he was never actually bewildered. But by the inscrutable arrangement of the Lord, because he's the perfect instructor, he was teaching this lesson to the great sages. And all the great living beings, not only like Lord Shiva, but all, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is mentioned in this verse. He has a great prayer, a great song about purification of the tongue. And his son, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, they all characterize themselves as imperfect, as very, very proud, very insignificant, very poor in their devotional service. Even Lord Chaitanya himself, he once said that I'm only a pretender. He was the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but playing the role of a devotee. He once said that I'm a great pretender. I act as if I'm a great devotee of Krishna, but actually I'm not. He said once that if I were actually devoted to Krishna, then I would not be able to even maintain life in this body. I would immediately leave this body. So I'm just a pretender, he used to say. So this is the humility of all great souls. They accept this position. Haridas Thakur also is very humble, even though he was a Namacharya of the holy name. He would not try to enter the temple of Jagannath because he knew it would cause social disturbances. So he felt himself unqualified, and he just gazed at the chakra on the top of the temple from his bhajan kutir. Prabhupada once told us that this is equal to seeing the deity. If you just see the chakra on top of the temple, it's equal to seeing the deity in the temple. So he was very satisfied with that, and out of his satisfaction and his humility and his great devotion, Lord Chaitanya personally came to see him. So he actually not only had darshan of the chakra, which is as good as Krishna himself or Lord Jagannath, but the Lord personally came to him personally and spoke with him in the form of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So as Prabhupada points out, in the living entities born in this material world, there are many obligations, as this famous verse says, Devarshi Bhutapta Nrinam Pitrinam. One becomes obligated in this great network. It's like a network, just like we have the internet. It's a big network. There's media networks that go out, and they involve millions and millions of people. There's also a network of obligations, a network of Maya. When we're born in this world, we're sort of bound up, just like we read about Bali Maharaj. He came bound up by his greed, and he was tied up with ropes. He couldn't move. So as we come into this material world, there are so many what we might call karmic obligations. We're obligated to our parents, to our forefathers, to all the living entities, to all the great sages, to the demigods, the rishis, the forefathers. And these are real obligations. But the conclusion of the Bhagavatam is that if one can become a pure devotee or engage in pure devotional service to the Supreme Lord, then all these obligations can automatically become fulfilled. Lord Vishnu had asked Daksha at one time to, with his progeny, to progenate or propagate living entities all over the universe. But he became frustrated when his sons the Hariyashvas and the what was the other group called? The Subalashvas? Hariyashvas and what is it? Savalashvas. He had 10,000 sons, the Hariyashvas, and the Savalashvas another 1,000 sons. Narada Muni, traveling all the over the universe as a great liberated soul, instructed these sons of Daksha that they should become brahmacharis, that they shouldn't take families and progenate the universe as Lord Vishnu instructed Daksha to do. So he gave all the reasons why you should not get entangled in material life. You young boys, you should take this opportunity in early life as Prahlad Maharaj instructed. And from the very beginning of life, you don't have to wait. You can take the renounced order, or you can give up material life. You can make a vow. You can be a lifelong celibate. Of course, very few people can do this nowadays, practically impossible. But these are the instructions Narada Muni gave. It would be Nastika Brahmacharis. So this happened, and they understood that these were actually very intelligent instructions. And in this way, they were disobeying an order. We might say not only from their father, but from the order of Lord Vishnu. So this angered Daksha. He thought, my instruction from the Supreme Lord is being frustrated. What can I do? And then he criticized Narada Muni for instructing his sons to take this vow of celibacy. If you're wearing the dress of a mendicant, but actually you have no right to do so because you're not following Vedic instructions. And he became so angry, he had a tendency to become angry, that he cursed him. And his curse was that because he was not acting properly, he was wearing the dress of a mendicant and he was giving wrong instructions, that he would have to move throughout the universe for all eternity. He could never stay in one place for more than a few days. And interestingly, Prabhupada writes in the purport to that verse, there's a series of verses there, that he says sometimes people become angry when we instruct renunciation. And he gave the example that when he had come to the West, he had many young disciples. And sometimes their parents became angry because they were instructed to give up their materialistic ways of life. Parents wanted them to sometimes take up their business, or they had some materialistic ambition for them to achieve a nice family, for them to have a good position in society, take over the business, get a good education. And when Prabhupada came to the West, many young people dropped out of the mainstream current of material life. So sometimes the parents became very angry and even tried to kidnap their children. There's a whole history there. So Prabhupada writes about this and says that maybe the parents of my young disciples have also cursed me that I can't stay in any one place very long and I have to travel. We heard also that Prabhupada used to complain that whenever he traveled that he'd always fixed up his room. And in every room he went to stay in smelled like fresh paint. So he always complained everywhere he went. Smelled like fresh. He could never get a place that didn't have odors of ether and alcohol in it. So this was kind of a curse. But Prabhupada writes in the purports that now he was saying, in my old age, I want to transfer this curse to my disciples, especially to my brahmacharis, sons, and sannyasis. I want them to travel all over the world and stay in one place for only a few days so that I can continue my translating work. I can sit in one place very peacefully and translate and produce these books which he was instructed to do by his Guru Maharaj. Of course, as Prabhupada once said, I practically had to walk through fire to start this movement. He really didn't get much of a chance to retire. He kind of wrote on the fly, you might say, and didn't really get that opportunity. But nonetheless, he translated perfectly for, as he said, the next 10,000 years. The constitution would be the purport of Srimad Bhagavatam. So Daksha was very disturbed at this. Narada Muni, he was powerful enough to counter-curse Daksha and do anything he wanted, but he, as also a great soul who felt very humble, like Lord Shiva and like the other great sages, he accepted very nicely. Just like Chitraketu, he was also cursed. He became a demon. He accepted it very nicely. He didn't care. Whatever you say, this is the right thing for me. I deserve it. course, Daksha, he didn't realize. In anger is said to destroy the good qualities of human beings. He didn't realize that actually Narada Muni was not in violation of the Shastras. Although one is obligated, if one becomes a devotee of Krishna, these obligations are fulfilled. And if one of the obligations to the sages, to fulfill those obligations to the sages, is to be brahmachari, to fulfill a vow of brahmachari. That's one way that the sages, the great sages of yore, are fulfilled. Although to fulfill the obligations to one's parents, one is meant to have progeny, and one is meant to undergo certain austerities to satisfy the demigods. But to satisfy sages, one can undergo the vow of brahmacharya. So Narada Muni wasn't actually violating the Vedic Shastras. He was fulfilling one of the important injunctions. And by Krishna's arrangement, the order of Lord Vishnu that Daksha would... The order of the Lord was ultimately fulfilled, because the order of the Lord can never not be fulfilled. It's always perfect and beyond any mundane inebriety. So the Lord's order is always fulfilled. Another point here is that Gotomu Kundam Parihuti Kartam, that if one actually enters into pure devotional service, which is free from jnana yoga, karma yoga, if one is fortunate to really engage in pure devotional service, then this is the perfect form of liberation. Liberation was mentioned in the previous verse. One tries to enter different types of, by being a yogi or by being a jnani, by being a karmi, by practicing these different types of yoga. But as it is stated by Rupa Goswami, it's Bhakti Rasamrita Sindha, Anya Vilashvara Sunyam, there's pure devotional service which is far superior to jnana yoga, karma yoga, very, very far superior to all forms of yoga. So this is what happens when one can actually enter into pure devotional service. It's not that one doesn't satisfy one's relatives or one's forefathers in apparently mundane ways, but by being a devotee of Krishna, Krishna gives sarvasyaham, sarvasyachaham, riddhi sannivishto. Krishna gives the internal instructions, the intelligence, how to go about fulfilling all obligations and desires, and all the different forces that one is obligated to. One gets the intelligence how to fulfill those desires by entering into pure devotional service. We had the example of Prabhupada in his life when he was in his last days. He spent many, many hours instructing his followers how to care for his family, how to provide for them, how to take various accounts out of his almira and fix them up so that they would be set up. So it's not that he was ignoring obligations, but Krishna was giving him direct intelligence how to fulfill all his obligations. So even though we have so many obligations to society, to our friends, to our relations, to our community, how to fulfill them, nobody knows, because the sense of what to do is not known by anyone, not correctly, not perfectly, unless one is a devotee of Krishna. Prabhupada once gave the example of the housewife who had a lover who was tending her husband more carefully, more attentively, because her mind was fixed on her lover. It was a bit of a gross example, but the idea is that if one is fixed on remembrance of Krishna, then one can fulfill all obligations, material obligations, very perfectly, very nicely. So Lord Shiva is praying for a daya or mercy from the Lord. Everyone needs the Lord's mercy, and if we become transparent enough to let that mercy flow through us, then we can fulfill all obligations and please the Supreme Lord. So I'll stop here. Do you have any comments or questions? Later, Prabhu. It says curiosity killed the cat. So, of course, doubt is also necessary. As Lord Kapila mentions, it's one of the five principal components of intelligence: doubt, correct apprehension, misapprehension, memory, and sleep. So it's not that it's necessarily in and of itself an evil or bad. The Prabhupada also gave the example of the intelligent boy who took the watch apart to find out how it worked. He wanted to know how it worked. So to try, and in the Isha Upanishad it said that we should learn the science of nescience along with the science of Krishna. So this is actually a symptom of being intelligent. That's why these great sages, they sometimes want to know, what is actually Maya? How does it work, and what is it? So, and the lesson is given by the Lord in his different manifestations. Usually it's a very kind of hard lesson, that this is what it looks like, this is what it feels like, and in the end they realize that this is actually not what I wanted. I wanted to know, but there's a kind of punishment that goes with it if one becomes too doubtful or too curious. Even after instruction has been given, intelligent instruction, then we have this kind of syndrome of people who stay on the outside of pure devotional service, just like we have within our movement. We were talking about this the other day. It's growing, growing, growing. And Prabhupada said, oh, now our enemies will come out when this deprogramming phenomena, the parents who are cursing us phenomena, started to come out. And we see that this actually grows. So one way it's explained sometimes by materialists is there's a weather report, and if it's it'll say partly sunny, but it also means partly cloudy. So you can look at it in different ways. You can say it's partly sunny, and I'll say it's partly cloudy. Or someone's will say it's a nice day, and the person who's got sort of a negative attitude will say, yeah, but it's going to rain. And there's nothing you can argue with it, because it is partly cloudy and it is going to rain. But it's a matter of attitude. It's a matter of where we place our faith ultimately. Do we place it in Krishna's ultimate rightness of what he says and what he guarantees? Dhammi Buddhi Yogam. If he says, I'll give you the intelligence, do we accept that? Or are we going to continuously stay on the outside and say, well, you know, maybe he really won't. Maybe this will happen. Or, you know, maybe I have to experience more and more of Maya to understand what it is. And sometimes we as devotees, you know, we hear, but sometimes devotees fall into that trap of thinking, I've got to more deeply understand the workings of Maya. So they get involved very much in reading newspapers, or maybe even enjoying material nature, so that I can, quote, better understand, end quote, how it works. So as you're rightly pointing out, to be too curious or too doubtful or too speculative about, and, you know, it's a symptom of not having deep and complete faith, both in Krishna and also that Maya is ultimately not satisfactory. I think Subal was telling me the other day in Bhadra Narayan's class that someone asked him, he quoted Prabhupada as saying that the reason my movement is successful, he said, is that I'm convinced that there's nothing in this material world that can bring any happiness. There's nothing ultimately worthwhile within Maya to really embrace. So one has to be very convinced of that there's so much enjoyment in the material world, but none of it is, it's like so many zeros without a one in front of it, without Krishna. Yeah. Oh, really? This is a letter that Mahaprabhu sent him. Maybe Chaitanya Bhagavad was in, was it? Yeah. Yeah, because when Prabhupada mentioned, he didn't give a reference. So this is very, very good to know. Anything else? About our... Sometimes in the past people have said, oh, I'm going to take sannyasa and leave a wife and children with nothing. So sometimes it's very wrongly construed that one can prematurely give everything up. But if we study the great sages carefully, and of course Prabhupada is the most immediate one that we have at our disposal to study, we can see what, even though he took sannyas, what great care he took to see that the obligations were all fulfilled, especially to his family members. He's very, very careful. And other examples we can cite are how he was very meticulous in how devotees should manage his movement. I remember he was teaching bookkeeping to Shyamasundara. He was teaching him how to not misspend a single penny. And he would write letters sometimes to Indian Overseas Bank and other banks that would receive transfers of money from the United States, sometimes $30,000, $40,000, $50,000. And if they would make a mistake in the bank transfer, if they didn't credit the account in India for a building project, say in Bombay, if they missed it by a few rupees or even a few paisa, he would personally write a letter. This is in the letters book. Said, "You have made an error in our account. You have debited us 6 paisa too many. Please correct this and make sure your records are straight," and so on. So he was very, very meticulous in seeing that things were done right. Everything should look nice. Temple should look nice. The Buddha should dress properly and be presentable. And the kirtan should be sung properly in nice melodies. And everyone should think that the temple should be so spotlessly clean. I got one letter. He said the floor should be like a mirror. Otherwise, you'll attract the rats. He said. Then people will be very impressed. They'll want to come back. So this is a very important point, that sometimes by reading this verse, people get the impression that they can abandon everything. And it's not the way the Prabhupada conducted one of his kind to run. Of course, Lord Chaitanya was Krishna himself, and he had to undertake these hardships to preach. But this is an exceptional case. And again, the philosophy of it is that one should be completely convinced that, as Rupa Goswami says, if you want to enjoy society, friendship, and love, don't even... He says very dangerous to look at Govinda, because he will cause you to give up friendship, society, and love. But giving up means not prematurely or not artificially. For example, Gadadhar Pandit took what was called Kshetra Sannyas. It was kind of like the Vanaprast. And most of Lord Chaitanya's followers, most of the ones we read about, I think most of them, at least half of them, were householders. And Krishna consciousness spread in South India, where Lord Chaitanya spent most of his time preaching, through, although he was the sannyasi, and there were a few other brahmacharis, but they were preaching in the Namhat program, where they would, like Kurma. Kurma wanted to give up everything. He wanted to renounce his family. And Lord Chaitanya said, "No, you go back to your village, preach to your family and friends, and make millions, thousands of devotees." And this was the system that they formed, these little, they sometimes call cell preaching today. they would gather together, and they would chant. They would speak from the Bhagavatam. They would take prasadam. They would speak philosophy to each other. They would chant together. They would instruct one another how to serve the devotees. They would engage in preaching activities. And they would become very, very convinced and fired up that this has to be conveyed. It has to be given to others in a very missionary spirit. So they would become empowered. That's the word Prabhupada is. They become empowered, and they would go to other villages, and they would convince them to invite their friends and their family to come. And they would again create another little group of, a whole village would become Krishna conscious. And this way millions of people became devotees. So it's not exactly, we can imitate great, great souls, but we have to be very responsible also. But philosophically, we have to be convinced that the only lovable object is Krishna. And that, that if one loves Krishna, then one can actually deal with everything else very nicely. One can love everybody, all things, all animals, all plants, all fish and reptiles and birds. So philosophically, we have to be convinced that, that we have to repose our love in Krishna. At the same time, you know, there's a tendency to think that we don't have to do anything. Just like the example that we were hearing, that we have to tend to our mundane affairs very meticulously. That's part of a symptom of being a great devotee. And of course, in India and in times past, sages, and especially in India, even today, a sannyasi can go from door to door and in a loincloth and wrinkled clothes and just a stick with a little tied up bundle of goods on it, and people will respect and appreciate very much. But that doesn't mean, of course, he's engaging in pure devotional service. In the Yukta Vairagya way of dealing, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, although he lived in India, he sometimes, and he would, during Chaturmas, he would mix the dal and rice and eat it off the cement floor with his hands behind his back. He also sometimes rode in British cars and had a very expensive British overcoat and turban on, and would sit with politicians and governors and would speak to Westerners. He would intermingle intimately, but he would speak with them for days and hours about philosophy. So it's according to, as Prabhupada said, utility is the principle. In this day and age, in this time and place, to have to dress like he did is almost the rule of the day. You know, have to be very presentable. Because people in this day and age, they're very superficial. They judge us by how we look, how we dress, and how we, you know, what kind of words we use when we speak, how nice the books are, you know, if they have a nice cover, if the pictures are nice, if the printing is good. Prabhupada, you know, he made great effort to make these books look very perfect and beautiful. But once in India, had sometimes letters printed upside down. You remember the old Bhagavatams? They had E's upside down sometimes. And Prabhupada came with those, but he spent 10 years laboring to make the books perfect. Just because, you know, people are going to look, they're going to put the binding, pages nice, it's a good paper. Are any of the withins changed to width? You know, they're going to check all this thing. I mean, that's what they look at, you know. Even though we know that to us the poetry was very beautiful in those early Bhagavatams. Yes. Which books are like that? You mean old? Well, the Prabhupada's books, Bhagavatamrita, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Bhakti Rasamrita Sanishvana, those are printed with a very high quality. Some books that are printed in India, devotees, they make them kind of cheap. I'm not sure. Well, some of the bindings? Okay. Yeah, I think there's a balance, as you say. I think the Bhagavatams and the Chaitanya Charitamrita are generally printed on pretty high quality paper. And then there's different people too. That, you know, some are more care more, like people that would buy a whole set of Bhagavatams in Chaitanya Chaitanya and put them on their bookshelves. They would insist on very high quality books. There's other people that will just, you know, want to read. They're more interested in the content of the book. Like we're talking about paperbacks especially, or maybe some of the Gitas, and they just want to read it. And later on, if they're really serious, they'll want to treasure the book. They'll buy a higher deluxe edition and put it in their bookshelf. That's more, I think, like European, American, Australian, Japanese are more quality conscious, these countries. Whereas if you go into the so-called developing countries, the devotees print books on lower quality. Because people aren't, they just don't care so much. You know, they're not so, it's a bit superficial in one sense to care, you know, what it, you know, how it feels and, you know, really look closely at the binding. But, you know, it depends on the person to some extent. Anyway. Hmm. I mean, probably the majority of books are not printed in English now, huh? I mean, if you consider Russian and Portuguese and Spanish, they all come from English, yeah. But I know in, I don't know, Subhas, is it? When they started publishing books in Russia, in the Russian language, it was the first time that I think almost that any, well, I think any mass numbers of books were printed of that high quality. Isn't that correct? Large quantities of books in Russia, in the Russian and Russian-related languages were printed extremely high quality. And it required a big investment, and yet these books actually sold in the millions. So, and it's got one of the worst economies in the world. Christian consciousness, a form of cultural conquest. So painters, like, I mean, really superb painters, there were many, Muralidhar and Bharat Raj and Vichy and Durga and Abhiram and Jagat Karna. I mean, they were, and still are, very, very, very talented people. So when Prabhupada had the vision of how the books would look, he thought they have to have pictures because people, again, in this kind of world of the modern world, so to speak, they're very enamored with art. In fact, when I was trying to get Prabhupada a visa one time in America, there was one of the forms you could fill out in the immigration form. If the person had a special cultural contribution, if it's a famous performing artist or famous fine artist, they'd almost immediately get an exemption and be able to come and even from an Indian passport and stay in America for an unlimited amount of time. So this is part of the idea of filling the books with beautiful pictures. So one thing is, even when there's cheaper paper, somehow we try to get a lot of good color pictures in there because people are completely in love with painting. They're very thrilled to see these beautiful pictures. So I think it's getting late. Let's stop here. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Srila Prabhupada Centennial ki jai. Radha Giri Hari ki jai.